Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I'm going to read this morning from Canto 3, Chapter 24, and the early part of the text number 6. Text number 7. Just to get the setting or the context of this. The previous chapter, called Devahuti's Lamentation, very wonderful chapter. Probably I should explain who Devahuti is, right? The Vedic picture of time is time moves in cycles. The very obvious one is the season changes. Summer, fall, winter, spring. Summer, fall, winter, spring. 1 year moves in a cycle of, at least here in this country, 4 seasons, different parts of the world, it's additional seasons, but it's cyclical. Or the cycle of day and night. Or the cycle of, there's different cycles. So, there's a cycle, a really big one is the cycle of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. The big one. The 2 parardas. And within that, there's a lifetime of Brahma, because Brahma is the creator, and then when the universe is finished, he's also finished. During the lifetime of Brahma, there's days, and then months, and then years, and 100 years. So in the day of Brahma, there's 1,000 cycles of 4 yugas, and within those 1,000 cycles of 4 yugas, there's 14 manus. Who are the manus? Manus are givers of law, dharma. From he is the conduit for the Supreme Personality of Godhead's intention for human beings, how to live their lives within the created realm, so that they're in harmony with the laws of nature, in harmony with God, and the higher purpose of creation and the higher purpose of life is fulfilled. So Manu gives those laws. 14 in every day of Brahma. And the first of them is named Swayambhuva Manu. And Swayambhuva Manu appears directly from the body of Brahma. Not only he appears, but his wife appears, and not only they appear in their mature stage. Doesn't like baby and youth and growing up and go to school and their mature stage from the time of their appearance. And they have a function, giver to give laws for mankind and to help populate the universe that Brahma just recreated with good offspring, good population. So, Swayambhuva Manu, together with his wife, Shatrurupa, they had 3 daughters, 2 sons. And Devahuti is one of those daughters. So Devahuti is the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, who is the first of the 14 Manus in the day of Brahma. And Devahuti, there's details presented in this earlier, she became married with Kardama Muni. Kardama Muni is highly qualified. He's a perfected being. He is a mystic yogi of amazing capacity. He's a performer of meditation to the degree that the personality of God had appeared before him, Lord Vishnu appeared before him, and told him, "You please me very much by your devotion. I know what your heart's desire is, because I'm in your heart, and you wish to have me as your son, and I will appear as your son." And he did, as the son of Kardama Muni and Devahuti. They lived together, Kardama Muni and Devahuti, for long duration, because in that first of the four yuga cycles, remember there's 1,000 of them in every day of Brahma, there's 71 during each Manu, so this is the first yuga cycle, and out of the 71 in Swayambhuva Manu's life, the duration of life is very long, by a multiple of 1,000, more than the maximum duration of life here. So, anyway, they lived together for tens of thousands of years, and Devahuti understands that after some time, it hasn't happened yet, but after some time, she will have a son with Kardama Muni, and that son will be the personality of God, and then Kardama Muni is going to leave and go back to the forest and do his meditation program. Knowing that, the previous chapter ends with her expressing her regret that she had the benefit of his association for so long, but her contemplations were on the material side, enjoying the company of her husband. Yeah, she's speaking in a manner of humility because that's her nature as an elevated person. She wasn't overly attached on the material platform to her wonderful husband, but she was saying, "I haven't sufficiently received from you the capacity to become free from the cycle of birth and death." And she's regretting that. So, in many verses, beautiful verses, indicating what the goal of life is and how to achieve it. So this chapter begins with Kardama Muni speaking to her, "My dear wife, you're a very elevated person. You're speaking words of humility, but you're seeking from me the means to achieve liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Here's how. In the mood of devotion, fix your mind upon the personality of Godhead, who will appear as your son, and he will give you the knowledge and everything else you require to achieve freedom from the cycle of birth and death." Of course, he could do that himself because he has that qualification himself. But that was the response he gave. So it's an instruction for us. If you want freedom from the cycle of birth and death, what do? You fix your mind upon the personality of Godhead, engage in his loving service, and either he or representative of him can deliver the knowledge and the means for achieving that. So she takes his instruction seriously. She takes it to heart and she begins performing exactly what he advised her to do. And her consort, it describes what she was doing externally and what was going on internally and the state of consciousness that she had achieved. And then little description, the previous verse, text 6, interesting. The impregnation of Devahuti by Kardava Muni. The interesting explanation is the personality of Godhead in his Paramatma feature is everywhere. He's in the spiritual realm, far beyond this material realm, and he's within the heart of every living entity by his plenary expansion or portion of his plenary portion, by his kala manifestation. So he is everywhere and he can appear from anywhere. And it's not a problem. He can appear from a pillar. He can appear from the heart of Maharishi Parikshit when Ashwatthama was trying to kill him within the womb of his mother even before he was born. He can appear from anywhere and he can retreat from anywhere to anywhere because he's everywhere. So the message that's given here is he appeared within the semen of Kardava Muni, and for him that's not a problem. He can appear in the womb of Devahuti even without that, because he can appear from anywhere and recede to anywhere. But it's because of their affection, their rasa of parental affection, he appeared that way. He appeared within the mind of Vasudeva, within the mind of Devaki, and within the womb of Devaki, there was no insemination. In this case, there's insemination, but it doesn't mean that the message that's in the previous purport is. It's the, one of the verses of Bhagavad Gita. Where Krishna, Srijamyaham. Srijami. He appears by his will. So he can appear this way, that way, the other way, however he wants. That's how he appeared in the eventuality of becoming the son of Kardava Muni and Devahuti. That was text 6. Text 7. And there's no purport, so read a few verses. At the time of his descent on earth, demigods in the form of raining clouds sounded musical instruments in the sky. The celestial musicians, the Gandharvas, sang the glories of the Lord, while celestial dancing girls known as Apsaras danced in joyful ecstasy. Text 8. At the time of the Lord's appearance, the demigods, flying freely in the sky, showered flowers. All the directions, all the waters, and everyone's mind became very satisfied. Purport. It is learned herewith that in the higher sky, there are living entities who can travel throughout the air without being hampered. Although we can travel in outer space, we are hampered by so many impediments, but they are not. We learn from the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam that the inhabitants of the planet Siddhaloka can travel in space from one planet to another without impediment. They showered flowers on the earth when Lord Kapila, the son of Kardama, appeared. Now this is kind of a fast forward. He's now appeared. So, text 9. Brahma, the firstborn living being, went along with Marichi, not to be confused with the Marichi and Ramayana, because this is a direct son of Lord Brahma, one of the, like Kardama, is a direct son of Lord Brahma. Marichi, that one. And other sages to the place of Kardama's hermitage, which was surrounded by the river Saraswati. Purport. Brahma, in this verse, is called Swayambhu because he is not born of any material father and mother. He is the first living creature and is born from the lotus, which grows from the abdomen of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Therefore, he is called Swayambhu, or self-born. Text 10, long purport. Maitreya continues. So Maitreya, this is a dialogue between Maitreya and Vidura. That's the whole scene is set from the beginning of this canto without all the details. Maitreya is a great sage, and having heard Krishna speak to Uddhava Gita, which comes later in the 11th canto, but he heard there were three persons present. Krishna, Uddhava, and Maitreya. So now Maitreya has become a perfected being from being a great muni, a great sage, a great person, learned personality. He's now become a perfected being. And Krishna told Maitreya, I want you to instruct Vidura, he will come. And Vidura came and Maitreya is instructing Vidura. So he's giving this whole narration it spans over a canto and a half of many, many, many different subject matters, very detailed subject matters. And so he's explaining this, the appearance of Lord Kapila and his teachings that take up the rest of the canto. Okay, so Maitreya continued speaking to Vidura. O killer of the enemy, the unborn Lord Brahma, who is almost independent in acquiring knowledge, could understand that a portion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his quality of pure existence had appeared in the womb of Devahuti just to explain the complete state of knowledge known as Sankhya Yoga. Angshena is the Sanskrit word, the plenary portion. Angsa, Angshena, plenary portion. Plenary portion means in the category of Vishnu. That's what it means. A portion of the Supreme Personality of God. So Vishnu is not, he's in the same Vishnu Tattva category as the Personality of Godhead, but he's not manifesting the fullness of the original Personality of Godhead. That's the meaning. So, purport. In Bhagavad Gita, 15th chapter, it is stated that the Lord himself is the compiler of Vedanta Sutra, and he is the perfect knower of Vedanta Sutra. Similarly, the Sankhya philosophy is compiled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his appearance as Kapila. There is an imitation Kapila who has a Sankhya philosophical system, but Kapila, the incarnation of God, is different from that Kapila. Kapila, the son of Kardava Muni, in his system of Sankhya philosophy, very explicitly explained not only the material world, but also the spiritual world. Brahma could understand this fact because he is Swarat, almost independent in receiving knowledge. He is called Swarat because he did not go to any school or college to learn, but learned everything from within. Because Brahma is the first living creature within this universe, He had no teacher. His teacher was the Supreme Personality, Godhead himself, who was seated in the heart of every living creature. Brahma acquired knowledge directly from the Supreme Lord within the heart. Therefore, he is sometimes called Swarat. And Aja means unborn, meaning he didn't have the normal mother-father kind of a birth. And second paragraph. Another important point is stated here. Satvenangshena. That's this word amshena again. When the Supreme Personality of God appears, he brings with him all his paraphernalia of Vaikuntha. Therefore, his name, form, quality, his paraphernalia, and his entourage all belong to the transcendental world. Real goodness is in the transcendental world. Here, in the material world, the quality of goodness is not pure. Goodness may exist, but there must also be some tinges of passion and ignorance. In the spiritual world, the unalloyed quality of goodness prevails, semicolon. There, the quality of goodness is called Shuddha Sattva, pure goodness. Another name for Shuddha Sattva is Vasudev, because God is born from capital V, Vasudev. Another meaning is that when one is purely situated in the qualities of goodness, he can understand the form, name, quality, paraphernalia, and entourage of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The word angshena, mentioned that already. The word angshena also indicates that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, appeared as Kapila Dev in a portion of his portion. God expands either as Kala or as Angsha. Angsha means, quote, direct expansion. And Kala means expansion of the expansion. There is no difference between the expansion of the expansion, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead directly, as there's no difference between one candle and another. But still, the candle from which the others are lit is called the original. Krishna, therefore, is called the Para Brahman, or the ultimate Godhead and cause of all causes. Just go back a bit. The verse is describing the higher beings in this universe, the Siddhas, Gandharvas, Apsaras, demigods, in higher realms, and it's not imaginary, they exist. And they're celebrating that the Personality of Godhead has made his appearance in this world, and Brahma has come, so that's spoken here in this verse. Brahma has come, he's in that category of higher beings within this universe, and with him came Marichi, one of his sons and great sages and so forth, and he's coming for a particular purpose. He has a service to do. The Personality of Godhead hasn't been born yet. We'll hear this as it's explained. He informs Devahuti before the child inner womb is born. Within your womb is the Personality of Godhead. What has happened previously, there's a nice painting of this also. There were nine daughters. That was discussed in chapter 23. Nine daughters appeared, and they're now of a mature age. So Brahma is going to say Kardama. These nine daughters should be given to this stage, that stage, the other stage. And the nine daughters with these sages are to have a service. And the service is to fill up the universe with good living entities. And there's interesting discussion about the origin of the species that's a little bit different than Darwin's idea. But it's in this section. So, emphasis on Brahma's position. This word Swarat. Swarat. I'm not so familiar with it, but I've heard Prabhupada say it when India became independent from the British. The word that was used regularly was Swaraj, right? Independence. Swaraj. So the Swarat is describing the person who is nearly independent. Nearly independent in the sense that there's one fully independent, and that's the personality Godhead. He's not dependent upon anyone. Brahma is so elevated that he's also being called Swarat. But nearly independent means, specifically Prabhupada's explaining, why is that word used? Because he acquired knowledge without a teacher. And that's not recommended. Don't try to acquire knowledge without a teacher. Whether it's, you know, becoming a physician or an engineer or a IT person or whatever it is. You go to college and you have teachers and you learn. That's the standard. And in spiritual matters also, that's the standard. It's the standard in spiritual matters because that's the arrangement given by the source of all knowledge. That's mentioned specifically in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says he knows Vedanta. Knowing Vedanta means it's the essence of all the Vedas. He knows the Vedas. He knows the essence of all the Vedas. He's the compiler of all the Vedas. And by the Vedas, he's to be known. That's the purpose of them. He knows it perfectly. Everything. So a good teacher knows that too. They know the Vedas. They know the purpose of the Vedas. Brahma's unique. There wasn't anybody to learn from. He was the firstborn living being. What teacher is he going to go to? So he went to his father, or his source of origin, Lord Vishnu. And from Lord Vishnu, he received knowledge. Or we can also say from Krishna. He received knowledge directly. We're not advised to do that. We're advised to receive knowledge from one who has received knowledge from Krishna, or the method of disciplic succession. That's recommended for us. Therefore, Brahma is in this special category. He is Swarat. Brahma acquired knowledge directly from the Supreme Lord, from within the heart. Tene Brahma Hrida Adikavaye Muyanti Yatsurayaha. Bhagavatam teaches. Hrida, from his heart, he received all the knowledge of the Vedas was revealed to him. And then it came out of his mouths. And he instructed his son Narada in particular and so forth. The line of disciplic succession flows from there. Then this other word is mentioned, Aja. Ja indicates birth, and Aja, the unborn. Unborn in the sense he was born and he dies, but he was unborn in the sense that he wasn't born in the normal manner. From a lotus, from the body of Mahavishnu. or Garbhodakshay Vishnu. So that's the first part of this purport. Then the second is Satvena Angshena. Satvena Angshena. So Satvena, it's Shuddha Sattva, different than Sattva, the mode of goodness. Just from a discussion yesterday, one of the students I spoke with at length had a lot of knowledge of, deeply absorbed in Buddhism. He'd read, many people that take interest in Buddhism don't know so much really what it is. They like the feeling of it and the ethics of it, but they really don't know it so much. This young man was well read and did. And so I was able to share with him, it's from this purport, there may be knowledge of the material world, and Buddhist teachings say there's entanglement in the material world, very similar to a Vedic notion. And therefore, Buddhism teaches the goal is nirvana. The goal is negation of this, or becoming freed from the entanglement of desire, because Buddhist teaching is the root of all suffering is desire. Remember this from the last time I was here, the Buddhism and Krishna. The root of all suffering is desire. Solution, become free from desire. And when you become free from desire, supposing you can do that, what's left? Nothing. So it's a choice. Something or nothing. And the something is desire that brings suffering. So the Buddha's choice is become free from suffering by becoming free from desire, and then you're left with nothing. And that's void. Next time I come, I'd like to speak on a topic that I just developed. It's the art of mindfulness. So just short. Mindfulness is it's being used all over the place commercially for all kinds of things to promote, just like green is being all over the place to promote, because so mindfulness is a Buddhist conception that it means essentially be in the moment. Don't be absent. Be present. Be in the moment. Be mindful of the moment, because all there is the moment. That's part of his teachings. I learned this from Tattvasandarbha. Jiva Goswami explains. They don't accept that there's consciousness. This young man understood it. There's no consciousness, there's no soul. All there is nothing. And how do you get to that state of realizing, becoming enlightened in voidism, is be in the moment. Because the past is gone and the future hasn't happened. All there is the moment. So be in the moment. And the breakthrough is beyond the moment, because in the moment there's a desire that's bringing your suffering. So just go beyond the desire, and what's left? Nothing. The goal of mindfulness for a Buddhist is nothingness. And the goal of mindfulness, well, let's go one more step. This is without any knowledge of the soul that's conscious and the spiritual realm, which is eternally existing. It's just describing the complication of the material world. So if you don't have any knowledge of the spiritual world, you don't have any knowledge of the soul, any knowledge of the source of everything, all there is nothing. Or the moment. And then beyond the moment is nothing. So, knowledge of the spiritual world starts with chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. There's a soul. And it's distinct from matter. So he rejected the Vedas. So he doesn't say there isn't a soul. But he doesn't say there is a soul. And there is. There is a conscious observer of, just like we shared last night, your thoughts, your emotions, what's going on in your body. It's one of the healing methods these days of be present. Trauma therapy. I've learned this from somebody that does it. You get present in your body and you feel something. You feel trauma, feel fear or whatever it is. And the teaching is stay with it. You know, be in the moment. And then it can help resolve that fear or that feeling that it's part of trauma therapy. There's other things and other things, but it's that mindfulness is part of that therapy. So, what's beyond, beyond for a follower of Bhagavad Gita is the soul. And the soul's eternal relation with the Supreme and being situated. So, bhakti yoga is being mindful of that. The art of mindfulness is who we really are and who we're part and parcel of and being in our relationship with he whom we are part and parcel of. Like this discussion about work. So Paul was sharing with me, had he not come with me to Urbana, he was invited to go to a Muslim interfaith discussion. Very refined Muslims, highly educated, very, they're on a mission of letting people know we're not ISIS. Those people are not us. So the topic that they want to discuss is what do different religions, how do they view work? Our view of work, karma yoga is you're detached from the results, but how to get there is not just a liberationist idea. I don't want the entanglement of karma. That's one idea. But who are we? The mindfulness idea of work is there's the senses, there's the objects of the senses, there's my karma, there's my modes of nature, guna, and I'm Krishna's servant. And let me engage in the moment, just, mindful of my relationship with Krishna. Go to school and do my studies and do your research or whatever it is. The art of work is being mindful of who you're doing that for. That where does the ability come from, the intelligence come from, the strength come from, the instruments of the senses come from. Because there's, according to chapter 18, Bhagavad Gita, there's five factors of action. And the ultimate one is Daiva. It's the Supreme. We need the other four. You can't do work without the other four. But you have to acknowledge Daiva. If you're going to be in bhakti yoga, or you're going to be connected with truth and reality instead of illusion, then, it's a small thing. But it's an essential thing. So, Buddhism doesn't teach that there's a soul, a conscious soul, and conscious of the Supreme. It doesn't go there. There's no spiritual world. There's no destination. After the cycle of birth and death, where do you go? You go to avoid it. Go to the river Viraja, which is neither here nor there. That's where Buddhists that actually achieve that state go. In between the material and the spiritual realm, the river Viraja. There's many other things to say, but this word angshena, Prabhupada is taking us through in the purport, it has two meanings. That angshena, that's a portion of the Supreme Personality of God is within the womb of Devaki, and that sattva angshena can mean either one of two things. It can mean that with him came all of his paraphernalia and everything else, all in the quality of shuddha sattva, pure goodness. It can also indicate, that the quality he's making this, the first point actually is shuddha sattva, sattvena angshena, that this realm of transcendence was within the womb of Devaki. Devahuti, thank you. So if she's spiritualized. Now, because she's in this super elevated position, one of her natural qualities is humility. She doesn't see herself that way. But that's what's going on. And Brahma understands it. So he's going to make some statements to the assembled people. They're the nine daughters and Kardama Muni and Devahuti minimally. And then surrounding him are his son Marichi and other sages. And he's going to make some declarations. That's the coming verses. Bhagavatam, fascinating, huh? Prabhupada wanted the whole world to have the opportunity, at least, to plunge into the ocean of Srimad Bhagavatam and at least have the opportunity to hear, understand, realize the spiritual reality that's far, far beyond this struggle of material existence. And the Bhagavatam takes you there, just sound vibration. It's wonderful. What a gift. Okay, so any discussion? Yeah.
Hi. So, what you just said that in Buddhist cultures, so there is the idea of negation. So
and there's the idea of
negation, and that they want to not involve their minds in gratification of sense and
yes.
things like that.
Yes.
But they don't go anywhere. They are between the material and the spiritual realm.
That's right.
So, because they don't believe in an idea of a God, so
that's
they
right.
reach there.
It's atheism.
Yeah, but do you think that it is still preparing them?
Yes, potentially.
For in the next life, because we need those qualities in us, right?
Yes.
That to realize that there is no happiness in the world, only then can we look towards a different path of life to acquire happiness. Or
yes, however. So, I'll say the same thing in a different way. It's taking wet wood and making it dry, so it can be ignited. It's taking wet wood, making wet wood dry wood, so it can be ignited. It's preparing them so that in their next lifetime, or some future, some existence, they may be able to, with controlled mind and senses, take up a life of devotion. It requires a few things, minimally. It requires association of someone who's carrying bhakti, to receive bhakti, or to have it awakened. Another thing, the however or but, is the heart becomes hard. That's the nature of a life where there isn't I'm not accountable to anybody. To get to where I want to go, I'm not accountable to anybody. It's in the divine and demoniac chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Anishvara. There's no Ishvara. There's no foundation to everything. Apratishta. It's a free fall. So, Their foundational conceptions that one becomes, to become effective, you have to buy into those foundational conceptions of life, and it makes the heart hard. It makes bhakti hard to enter into the heart of such a person. It's very hard, you know. I have found it's easier to have dialogue with Buddhists than impersonalists. Impersonalists, their hearts are very hard. They're explicitly, God has no form. And like that you heard the discussion yesterday. Well, there's no dialogue from Buddha's side about the soul. He just says, you know, it's irrelevant. We're not even going to talk about it because what we need to do is release ourselves from the entanglement of material world, so it's not even nirvachaniya, can't talk about it. So let's just do this. And he's read a lot, apparently. So worse than Buddhism, worse than those, that brand of atheism is the atheism that's explicitly offensive. Those persons are very difficult. It's difficult to have any interaction with them because it's offensive. If they really understand what they're saying. And some of them really understand what they're saying. It's offensive. So, you want something further?
Yeah, so if they're keeping the Buddha in their mind, then he's also...
Yes, exactly.
Buddha.
Yeah. There's devotional element in Buddhism if they follow it properly. Yes. Although it's you know, the ultimate is nothingness, there's a devotional element within it. But he doesn't say I'm God. Doesn't say he's not. Just, you know, reject the Vedas and listen to me. And fix your mind, you know, anyway. He doesn't say fix your mind on me, that followers say. The most, more detail, the most popular brand of Buddhism today in China, there's so many, but like, you know, in any theology, so many brands. But Pure Land Buddhism, I mentioned it in the discussion, and this Amitabha Buddha is a Buddha, not the original one, but a Buddha, because there's multiple Buddhas. And he created this Pure Land for people who can't do it. They can't get there. They can't get to that position of fixing their mind in nothingness. So he creates a somethingness place for them. Anyway. And part of the thing is say his name, think of him, and detach your mind from other things. It's bhakti toward Amitabha Buddha. Now, it's not, that's man-made. That's not Buddha that's spoken of in the Bhagavatam, first canto and second canto. It's a modernized, man-made version. Anyway. Something else? Yes?
I was just curious about when Lord Brahma is creating this, initial batch of people, does he create many beings of each species, or does he just create a starting point? For example, you mentioned that he creates Manu and his wife, but then also there are other sons, like Karjam and Marichi, and probably others.
Yes. And those other sons, with the wives of Kardama and Devahuti, produce generations of different species to help fill up the universe with different species. If you're interested in that topic, I can forward it, a text to you. It's Druta Karma's explanation from his understanding of how the various species come about from their Prajapatis. I seem to recall, kind of a weak statement, but Sataputta offering, not from scripture, but, you know, like a perhaps, those Prajapatis have a big gene pool. And because of the big gene pool, then they can produce species that have this genetic composition. He never heard anything like that. He has another explanation. But that's how the various species appear very, very early in the cycle of creation from the Prajapatis. They're empowered to do that. His explanation is basically they have a power to do that. And because they have the power to do that, they can do things that are otherwise not by the cause and effect of the material laws of nature, because they have an empowerment to do that. Basically, that's his idea. And all those powers are within the Supreme, and the Supreme empowers them. They have a service to do. They have the ability to do that service.
I vaguely remember reading or hearing that Lord Brahma creates many species from his mind.
I don't recall that. It comes from the Prajapatis. That's third canto explanation. If you come across that, you please share that with me. You send me a little reminder, and I'll send you with a Sruta Karma Prabhu's explanation of species from the Prajapatis and how that takes place. Anyway, the essential is this: they're empowered. Anything else? Yeah.
Lord Kapila Dev is in the categories of avatars. He's a Shakti Vesh avatar. That Sudha Sattva that comes before the word, what was the word?
Angsena?
Angsena. Sattva Angsena.
Yeah.
Is that what qualifies it as Shakti Vesh avatar, that is a Vishnu tattva?
No. Oh. I'm not ready to answer your question. I researched this very carefully from Rupa Goswami's Laghu Bhagavatamrita, and I can't remember at the moment. It's in my computer, but I can't remember at the moment. So I'd ask me when we get back to the house. My recollection is that he's not a Shaktivesh avatar, but he is Vishnu Tattva. And he's in a certain category of Vishnu Tattva forms that appear. And there's just, you know, he gives knowledge. There's no consort. There's no Shakti being manifest in his pastimes. Dattatreya is another in that category. And there's not a lot spoken about their lives. That they come, they give some teachings, and the only other major reference that I'm aware of is the descent of the Ganges, the sons of Sagara, brought by Bhagirath to the sons of Sagara, then their ashes were burned by Kapila when they tried to pounce on him to get the horse that was... You know that story. Other than that, and Kapila, after giving teachings to Devahuti, this is from Laghu Bhagavatamrita, he taught a number of others. So he went here and there. But the details of instructing those persons and where he went and so forth, it's not available in the Puranas other than he instructed this one, that one, the other one. At least to my knowledge. So Vishnu Tattva, not Shakti Veshavatar Vishnu Tattva. That's my recollection. Okay. Time for classes, right? Time for breakfast and then class. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.